This is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
John Doe.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be.
Thanks for tuning in to the Solidarity Journal. It's Tuesday, August 2nd. This week's show has a guest correspondence report from Hannah Offit, who spoke with Gavra Lynn, the creator and organizer for Peoria's new art movement called Art Show. Also, Hannah spoke with one of the featured artists at the art show, Anthony Corey, who gave his views, ideas, and feelings on art and where Peoria stands at in all of this. Later in the show, we'll have a special interview with Jack Ryan, former FBI agent who started becoming radical while seeing the injustices in the world, who then disobeyed orders to investigate and infiltrate a peace group back in the 80s. This further pushed him into become a peace activist, traveling the world wherever the U.S. was supporting terrorism against other people, in such places like Nicaragua, Cuba, and Haiti. As always, thanks for tuning in to the Solidarity Journal at WAZU 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for some world news and local events.
Voluntary movement. Put on your corset, put on your corset, put on your corset, put on your corset, to support your abdomen, your machine, and everyone believes you.
Future events this week. World History, a band which will be played throughout this show, will be playing down at the Red Barn this upcoming Thursday, August 4th at 8 p.m. They'll also be performing with other great musical talents such as Real Live Tigers, Derek Hart, The Dirty Gentlemen, and much more. Also, the Peoria Progressive Community Organizing Meeting will be held this Wednesday, August 3rd. At 6:30 p.m. at the Waterhouse Banquet Facility in downtown Peoria. Attend this meeting and share your concerns and ideas and how to foster better communication and cooperation in the Peoria Progressive Community. Now we'll have Hannah Offit with her report on the art show.
Art Show, located on Jefferson across from the Civic Center, is a new art gallery in Peoria. I spoke to Gavra Lynn about the inception of Art Show and what brought her to Peoria from Alabama by way of the Gulf of Mexico.
Mostly I lived in North Carolina. I lived in Asheville, North Carolina for 10 years. And then from there I moved to Alabama on the Gulf Coast. I lived down there 5 years until the recent BP oil spill. And that really wrecked, and it's still havoc down there, but it wrecked my livelihood. And it kind of was a window that opened up. First, Art Show was a vision I had in Alabama of a group abstract art show in Peoria. This was before I moved home. I grew up here, and I've been gone 23 years, and I came back last summer. And when I decided to move back, I was driving to work at the marina down in Alabama, and in my mind, I just saw this group art show in Peoria. And it was called Abstract Plus Multiply Equals the Emotive Math. where Art Show came from was I just had to buy some letters, and I certainly wasn't going to pay for abstract plus multiply equals the emotive math and put that on that sign when everybody would be like, what is that? So I thought, well, Art Show, that'll be good enough. So I got those letters and slapped them up there. And, you know, as time goes on, I like Art Show. That it's kind of cool. It's so to the point. Yeah. And, anyway, April, it just, I put flyers around town and calling for abstract artists. 15 artists responded. And thus, that was the abstract show. And then during the month, it got more popular, and we had events. We showed independent films. There were a lot of musical events. People started hanging out there. It started to be kind of a little vortex in for creative people.
Who were some of the artists featured at Art Show?
Ragad Rustom has a whole room to herself. Eddie Art Machine. Anthony Curry. Deborah Schmidt. Keith Wilson. Augie. Stormy Monday. And myself.
Anthony Curry's work at Art Show particularly struck me. His bold artistic expression, incorporating themes of darkness. I met with Anthony and asked him what inspired the art that he made.
Most of the stuff I work with, I work with a bunch of different mediums. I started out, I did art through all my childhood years. It was always a little bit abnormal. It was just the way I looked at things. I always try to make stuff look like how it should, but then I realized I couldn't do that. So I used reverse psychology on myself and worked with what I had and made what I did was a little bit different than what was projected to be normal here in Peoria.
I felt particularly curious about Anthony's flower paintings done in Merlot. Yes, that medium-bodied red wine Merlot.
The first gen of Merlot paintings were more abstract, and then the second gen started more abstract flowers, and now I'm on the third cycle of it, and just using different wine as a watercolor instead of standard watercolors. I mean, you could go out and buy the color purple, but, I mean, that's pre-made. When you use something that's not a technique, that's where it gets developed, and the creative element outstretches your mind and gets people interested about that medium. With Merlot, I was just mainly, I like the color, and it's kind of you consume your own medium. I know people that eat paint, and I remember people that used to eat glue in grade school, but I paint with wine and I drink my wine. I switched from Merlot to Chardonnay and Cabernet lately. And the Cabernet has more of a purple tint, and the Merlot is a little bit more denser red. And the Chardonnay, I just throw a little bit, a splash of that in, just to add more yellow highlights. And it's hard to get that more controlled on paper than the deeper set colors. That has to sit and seep for quite a while for the residual, like a yellow color, to come through on a white paper.
Anthony gave his take on what he felt was the most prevalent type of art in the Peoria art scene.
The movement here in Peoria is pretty cool. There's a lot of diversity. There's a lot of people, jewelers. There's a lot of jewelers here and woodworkers. There isn't many people that work in the medium of painting and stuff like that. It's more crafts around here, but I think that's what sells more, honestly.
Peoria's art scene is primarily devoid of eccentric and or controversial art, as this type of art is not easily understood, accepted, or paid.
I never tried to copy anyone. I just did what I did, and I didn't care if anyone really liked it. But being persistent my whole life, it tends to draw a crowd, I guess, when you don't give up. And I'm good at giving up. I think we all are. But you gotta accept failure when it comes and not have it drag you down either way. You just pick yourself back up again and carry on. Like, I like a hard criticism on artwork. It could be torturous, but it's better than no criticism at all. I'd rather someone say they didn't like it than they really liked it a lot. That it disturbs me, because then that becomes a casualty of what is normal.
Anthony incorporates found objects into his work. Resurrected deer bones finds a place in Anthony's work called Lazarus.
A lot of stuff I've worked with is stuff that I just, on a whim, just some garbage I found. Like, there's a skeleton at art show called Lazarus. It's three goat spines put together, or deer spines put together, a goat head and geese wings, and it stands about 6 foot tall. Named him Lazarus from the biblical term, as I've risen him from the dead, but it's a new creature, it's a morph, it's a new form of a blend of society as it is all changing. I mean, feel like with Lazarus, since he is just a carcass I found on the ground, multiple carcasses I found and boiled down to bone and removed all the flesh and everything else that was stuck to it. I made the dead dance again, and I brought new life to something that would possibly be buried by society because it's unapproachable to some people. I've seen a couple people view some of my pieces and just be like, why would you do that? And I'm just like, why wouldn't I? And it's just like, it's hard for Peoria sometimes, not to shoot Peoria down. I love it. Born here, raised here, proud of it. But I think the more disgust you get, the better it becomes. Lately, I've been working with, I live across the street from a junkyard, and I've just been picking up rusty circles, as in the cycle of a circle, the infinity of it, and rust as it shall always return. Once it settles in, it's permanent decay and in nature's form. And just been working with that. With some mixed media and painting, and actually using leaves and spray painting them different colors, and just choosing more.
I asked Anthony how long his art would be displayed at art show.
How long is your artwork going to be shown at art show?
Actually, I don't know. it's been up there for 3 months. Oh. She kind of said I could leave my stuff up there, and I've sold a few pieces since. And I mean, it would probably, it's all older material, and as I grow with art, I make new art. It's all a progression. So I'm always constantly productive with that, and a lot of those pieces are older pieces from the past 2 years, and so it's a good place to represent them in the structure of the beginning to the end of where it was started and what movement or what was affecting my life at the time, or what even was a casualty of society. With that factor, I think it's cool that it still stands at art show. Even though it's been there 3 months, it's still new to majority of people that walk in there. And it is early developmental stage of what I titled abstractionism. Abstractionist, and not a formatted term, just something I made up that sounds suitable.
Gavra speaks on her experience curating art shows in the Chapel Hill and Asheville, North Carolina. The need for artists who are often reclusive to have a space to not only showcase their works, but to come together and meet other artists, as well as those who appreciate abstract art.
Curating art show was easy for me because I've done it before. I've curated group shows before, and I did that in Asheville. There was a series of From the Gut, the Feminist Fine Art Show that I did every other year. And sometimes there'd be 33 artists in it, and it would just be for, you know, a month, like this show was intended for. So that's kind of how that abstract show I had a vision for, you know, was kind of how I did it before. So, I didn't know what was gonna happen in Peoria. I didn't even know if there were artists in Peoria. I'm just so amazed at how many creative people are in Peoria. It's exciting, and that's what I think art show is good for. Is you know, it's a welcoming environment, and being able to just be free to show all kinds of people's work. You know, all ages, all styles, all levels of you know, experiences or emotions, and you know, I just think it's kind of cool that it kind of bridges gaps. You know, like it can be a melting pot, and I think that's why it's keeps growing, because it's filling a need. You know, and I think that's a need in any community. I think that, you know, offering a space for people to come together of like minds in a community, you know, where they meet each other, that's a positive thing. In the art world, usually you have to have your portfolio and you have to have your body of work, and then you apply, and there might be, you know, only X amount of galleries to maybe get a show within the next year. Mm-hmm. And, you know, lots of rejection and little opportunity. You know, it's hard to be an artist if you're an actor or a musician or anything like that. When it comes to in the entertainment kind of world, the rejection abounds. But in the art world, visual art, it's even, I don't know, more impacting, because, you, like you said, artists are already reclusive. You know, then you try real hard to get one show in 1 year, and you don't get it. You know, where do you go from there? So having a community space is cool, because there's a 17-year-old down there. There's a 77-year-old downstairs, you know, artist. And I think that's just a cool thing, yeah. It gives people an opportunity to first show, have a place to show.
Gavrilin is also a singer-songwriter and guitarist. Before I left, she performed for me an original song on guitar.
Okay. I'll play a song. This is called Care and Bleed.
Okay.
Do you daydream? Do you know about lilies in the buttercream? Sky rockets assemble in the mirror of the day. And I only want to care and bleed. I only want to care and bleed. The dusty wild by the touch of your soul, it's appalling that you don't want to care and bleed. You're too scared to care and
If you are interested in viewing Anthony's art and other artists at Art Show, please come to Jefferson across from the Civic Center.
With the Obama administration attack on whistleblowers, like Bradley Manning, or former government agents who speak out against wrongdoing done by their government, such as former CIA officer Jeffrey Sterling, who leaked information that showed a severely 11-year botched agency plot to infiltrate Iran's nuclear program, I thought I'd meet up with a Peoria man who also showed dissent when he was once given orders to commit something that was unethical. This past week, I visited and sat down with Jack Ryan. Jack had an interesting story of being a former FBI special agent for more than 21 years, and what led him to become an activist and fight back the very system he once worked for. So how long have you lived in the Peoria area?
I grew up here. I was in the seminary trying to be a priest 4 years, and I was halfway through, and I decided that was my calling, and I came back here, got a job on the police department, and then I got drafted and went in the Army 2 years. Came back, got back on the police department, and decided to apply for the FBI, and I got in. I did a lot of work with informants. That was one of my fortes. I had a lot of informants, an awful lot, and a couple mafia member informants.
Now, when things started to change for you within the FBI, when your outlook on how things were being done there, when what was it that to step back and look at whether or not it was right?
In one way, I was oblivious. I played the game. I mean, we had illegal wiretaps all over the place.
Like the mafia?
Yeah, okay. yeah, they were. And in our mind, it was justified, whether they're legal or not. The way we handled informants was criminal in that, some of the informants didn't exist. And the best way to protect a good informant was actually give his information to somebody else so that if he's ever caught, that other person would get the heat. He wouldn't. Mm. And or assigning information we got off an illegal wiretap or illegal microphones to an informant. You got to do something with that information. And all these things, we swore in court, raise our hand and, affidavits for wiretaps, legal wiretaps, search warrants. A lot of it was based on informant information, and whether the informant information was accurate, who cared?
Was there any point where you were able to find out if, in the end, if that information from the informant was good or not?
Oh, often, yeah. And a real informant is amazing. You listen to these tapes, and you listen to them, these wiretaps and microphones, all this information, and most of it's bull. It was intelligence for the sake of intelligence. I mean, it was a game in itself.
Jack then went to Arizona and Utica and New York before heading to St. Louis, investigating the mafia in each city. Jack was then transferred to Springfield, Illinois' office, and then back in East St. Louis, since his background had a lot of involvement in organized crime. He got neck deep in it and was working informants once again. Then while in East St. Louis, things started changing for Jack.
I've been a Catholic, staunch Catholic all my life. When I left the seminary, it was kind of a defeat, looked at it as a failure, and always wanted to get active in the church. Well, down there, my wife got involved in scripture classes. And same time, I'm working in East St. Louis, and I'm learning about the prophets, the Old Testament prophets, and what they were really about. And what they were the critics of the power structure. They took up the cause of the people that were being persecuted or were downcast in those days. And that's what they were. And here I'm working in East St. Louis, and I can see this. What a miserable city. A third world city right here in this country.
Then Jack was transferred back up to Peoria, and by then was starting to burn out on the FBI. This is when he discovered a local Catholic worker house. The Catholic Worker was founded by Dorothy Day and Peter Maurin during the Great Depression. Both were Catholic anarchists that helped start the Worker around the ideals of unwavering pacifism while condemning the private and state capitalism for its immoral purpose of profit and wealth over empathy and helping those in need in a society that gradually becomes more brutal. The Worker's way of doing things was different from other agencies or groups. It just didn't feed or help the weak and in struggling. It looked at what caused it. This moved Jack, and so he started meeting the peace activists in Peoria, like John Greiner, and saw the radical groups in Rockford.
So I came up here, and I was pretty much burned out on the FBI, and this office is traditionally, it's always been kind of a do-nothing office. And also the FBI was getting very, very contentious, very intent. And also I started hanging out down the Catholic Worker House. Peoria had one. And nobody in the office thought anything of it. They knew it, Nobody had any idea of the radical nature of the Catholic Worker. Became involved with the Catholic Worker quite a bit, and it was making an influence on me. Through that, I started meeting some of the peaceniks here in Peoria. And, that was a big breakthrough for me, just to see that attitude, and then meeting some of the people that would come through, the Catholic Worker types.
The Catholic Worker also got him involved with what the U.S. was doing in Central America. The 14 families, which were the wealthiest families that had most of the political power, were in the U.S. pockets, and they also had the military and CIA helping them with the El Salvador government in Central America, using terrorism to quash any uprising or people's movements. Oscar de Romero was once a mouthpiece for the wealthy, but then he started to see what was happening to the people of his country and began to speak out. He started doing liberation theology, which was a theology that was based on the New and Old Testament, that God's option is with the poor, who need help, and that as a Christians, it is our job to stop this attack against the poor. The day before he was assassinated, Romero addressed the Salvadoran military and security forces and pleaded with them by saying, "In the name of God, in the name of this suffering people whose cries rise to heaven each day more loudly, I beg you, I beseech you, I order you in the name of God, stop the repression."
But gradually I was getting more and more involved in that way of thinking. And another thing going on then, well, Central America was a big thing. Terrorism was still going on big in Central America, which had been for years, and we were supporting it all. Training them, sending them weapons, probably actual help, covert help, and, you know, fighting communists. And that justified anything. If they're a communist, you can do anything to them. And if they're not communists, they're fine. You know, you're talking about these dictators down there. The big shock was when Oscar Romero was killed. He's the Archbishop of El Salvador. And it was just reading about it, and we backed it, totally.
Jack started to get more involved with activism, even attending a march in Peoria as an FBI agent.
Then another thing, there was a Sane Freeze. So two peace organizations that merged, and they were anti-nuclear weapons, had a march. It started at Morton Square, which is up near the cathedral, and there's a couple hundred people, and marched downtown, the police escort, to courthouse, and there were speakers there. Well, I joined it. There was kind of a little clamor, you know, here's an FBI agent among us, and I remember going down downtown, we're in the mob, and the policeman I know was riding the squad car, you know, just to help traffic. Nonchalantly driving, you know, along with us, and he looks at and sees me, and he goes, "Oh, my God." He's startled, and then he leans back and gives me a big wink. I understand, and, you know, and I laughed about it. If I was undercover, he blew it there.
Then Jack met Terry Hatfield with Pledge to Resistance, which was a group against America's involvement in Nicaragua. Since Nicaragua had a democratically elected government that the U.S. didn't want to see in power, the U.S. then ended up using terrorism to shut it down through the Contras, and this happened during the Reagan administration.
Sometime while all this was going on, Terry Hatfield, the area coordinator of Pledge of Resistance, and they sent a thing out, and it just said, "Sign your name and pledge that if we invade Nicaragua," which was a fear then, U.S. military go down there and invade it, "that I'll do something to help the effort to protest." And I filled that out, put my name, address, and right down at the FBI office, I dropped it in the mailbox. I did that as the most radical thing I ever did in my life. I almost felt the earthquake.
Jack believed in the FBI and didn't question the intentions, or believed that they wasted their time doing other illegal things. Later on in life, he reconsidered and saw this as a naive assumption, especially with the abuses that the FBI committed during the 60s when the civil rights activists would meet, march, or rally. The FBI would be there watching them closely. Then Jack got a lead who caught someone putting glue in locks at a recruiting office in Chicago. The lead gave a name, Gene Gump. Gene Gump was an activist who once would march with Martin Luther King Jr. during the Civil Rights Movement, and also did weekly picketing outside the federal building in downtown Kalamazoo to protest the U.S. military action. After this lead, the questions came down wanting to know about Brian Wilson and his group, Veterans Fasting for Life.
But that's, you know, what's going on in my mind, and I'm waiting to retire, and I also don't believe the FBI is harassing activists like they did back in the 60s. You know, and I just assume we've learned our lesson, and we've got guidelines that say we can't do that anymore. Our director then, Webster, William Webster, he's from St. Louis, he wrote a letter to the editor, St. Louis Post-Dispatch, saying, you know, point blank, the FBI is not harassing or investigating nonviolent peace activists. And then I get a lead that says we're investigating four people fasting on steps of the Capitol over in Nicaragua.
These are four guys: Brian Wilson, Charlie Litke, Duncan Murphy, and George Mizo. And you know, bingo! I just realized, hey, I might be upset with our military or CIA or government policy, but now all of a sudden, the FBI, we're part of this too.
Jack ended up making one of the biggest decisions of his career.
And I just, when I got that memo investigation, you know, I just choked, and here it is. You know, now I see it. What am I going to do? And I kind of, you might say, painted myself in a corner. It was with my radical ideas, and now what am I going to do about it? Because this is it, a clear case of the FBI investigating nonviolent activists. I put a memo in, said I wouldn't do it.
He wrote a memo to the FBI that read, "The memo contains a lead for Ryan to conduct an investigation, events possibly similar to the incidents in which captioned subjects are subject. Because of Ryder's personal religious and human beliefs concerning the issues that appear to be involved, Ryder is not willing to conduct this lead or be involved in this case, and feels the FBI is ill-advised to be so involved in this case as a domestic security, terrorism, sabotage case based on the following reasons. The acts performed by the Plowshares Group, although clearly involving destruction of government property, have been consistently nonviolent, symbolic statements against violence." Jack also said, "Although having no knowledge of the subjects nor their motives, he was convinced were totally nonviolent, and it was in his belief that none of the actions of the Plowshares Group or the Veterans Fast for Life fit within the domestic security guidelines, and that the FBI would hold credibility by distancing itself from such an investigation." And then Jack went on to explain his reluctance to be involved in this case does not mean that he disagrees with the FBI's position on the terrorism or domestic security. And Jack said later on there was a full court press on the group's Veterans Fast for Life, and that it showed that there was, in fact, no violence that was committed. So Jack put the memo in the FBI outbox and waited. Then he got a call from his boss, Tom Jones.
2 days later, I get a call from the boss, and he said, "I got your memo. I could tear it up, but just say you had a bad day." I said, "No, I don't want to tear it up." And he said, "I didn't think you did." And he said, "Well, you better come in. We got to talk about it." So I went in, and he and the number two guy, Jim Orr, put me under oath. And first, no, they ordered me to right then to do it, to conduct that lead. And I said, "No." I said, "Okay, I want you to put it in writing that you won't." Okay, so that was the offense I was fired for, refusing a direct order. I put it on paper because I didn't want to back down.
Jack didn't think he would be fired, but according to Jones, would get some beach time, which is suspension. Jack had little over a year to go before retirement, and he knew if he were in fact suspended, the FBI would just ask of him to investigate the group after he returned from suspension. Then, on September 11th, Jack finally got a reply from the FBI.
Then there was almost a year, and no decisions were made on any disciplinary, anything, you know. And finally, they all came out at once, and I was just one of them, and I got fired. I went home, Peg, my wife, she was prepared for it. She was upset, very upset, but she knew it was coming.
After Jack was fired, he had to sell his house, hired some lawyers, and pay for their fees to go after the FBI for firing him, for doing something noble while other agents had done things much worse. The FBI eventually notified Jack's lawyer, stating that they wanted to bring him back and have him retire, but they end up trying to make things more difficult, like reduce him a grade for his, quote, poor work record, which was absurd since he never had a bad record. Nonetheless, Jack decided that he would go back, but then found out the FBI decided against it and had him fired anyways, for reasons that still go unexplained to this day. Elaine Hopkins, former journalist at the Peoria Journal-Star, and now editor at Peoria Story, picked up on Jack's story and approached him. He first passed on her offer to do the story, but later went back to Elaine.
So I went down there and gave her the story, and they took my picture. And bingo. Next day it was the headline, and the phone ringing off the hook. Reuters, AP, UP, just all over everywhere. And, yeah, it just went on and on. The phone hang up, boom, it rang again. And that went on for a couple days.
When we come back, we'll return to what happened to Jack after being fired from the FBI and what led him to his life of activism. So stay tuned for the second part of Jack Ryan's story. Welcome back to part two of Jack Ryan's story. Before we took a break, Jack had talked about how he had been a former special agent of the FBI and worked with informants in the mafia, and then one day had received orders to investigate a peace group that was doing a fasting in Washington, D.C. He disobeyed orders, finding that the peace group was not a threat and did not fall under any code of terrorism. This eventually led to Jack being fired from the FBI. And then becoming a peace activist. Jack also had been involved with the newly formed peace group in Peoria, which he found out about at the Worker House. Maya Sloan got him interested in the group. And then from there, with his story out in the public, Jack went on the beans and rice circuit, did about 35 colleges telling his story of being a former FBI agent. And then Jack was contacted by John Stockwell, who was a national security chief. He previously had Oliver North's job, but then he turned after what the CIA was doing in Africa. And then Stockwell organized a group called ARTIST, which is Association for Responsible Dissent, which had Brian Wilson, Phil Rettger, Phil Aggie, and whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. The group reorganized later called ADSUN, Association of National Security Alumni, which was made of mostly CIA case officers and analysts. Also in the group was Brian Wilson, who was the very man that Jack had to investigate with Veterans Fast for Life. They ended up hitting it off well, and soon went to places like Nicaragua and Cuba. Jack eventually went into Nicaragua to see the footprint that the U.S. was leaving, since it wanted a government there that supported the U.S. empire.
And Nicaragua was the only open country in Central America. And, you know, we had an embargo. They couldn't get parts, couldn't get anything from the U.S. We were really punishing them. And then we were down there right before the big election, when the Sandinistas got voted out. And it was purely trying to satisfy Uncle Sam, you know, get him off our back. And then the U.S. aid that was going to come in, if they were replaced, none of it came in. Nicaragua became about the poorest country in, next to Haiti and all the whole hemisphere.
Then Jack went to Cuba, where the U.S. had been punishing the country for decades, or as one U.S. historian, William Appleman Williams, described, as the, quote, tragedy of American diplomacy. Unlike Nicaragua or Haiti and other countries, Cuba was successful in establishing a revolutionary government in opposition of the U.S. Jack was there just right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which at the time had been giving Cuba its oil. So Cuba had to discover a new way of living to survive.
And so you went to Cuba also with Brian. And what
just we were guests of the Cuban government and fact-finding. Why does the U.S. hate Cuba so much, and that they're human too, and they wanted us to see their way of life. And,
with the way of life there in Cuba compared to here in the United States?
Pretty hard. It was hard.
And this was after, was this after Russia?
We were right there when the gas lines started, when they cut Russia turned, you know, flipped the switch. We were there that week. And all of a sudden we saw these long lines, and it was to get gas. And then it was also announced that Castro just ordered 20,000 bicycles, Czechoslovakia.
Then Jack went to Haiti not too long after to meet Aristide, who had just been elected after decades of brutal regimes that were supported by the U.S.
We were there shortly after, not too long after he was elected. The CIA told Jimmy Carter, who was down there watching the election, that he didn't have a chance. Aristide did not have a chance, but because he represents the slum dwellers. And that when he loses and he's going to get swamped, that there's going to be massive rioting. That was the CIA analysis. So Carter came to him and begged him to withdraw from the election because of the trouble that's going to happen, that he doesn't have a chance. And he won, I don't know, 70% of the vote. And, you know, just a landslide. And it was just a real breath of air. Well, one day they said giving salt to the zombie. That's what snaps a zombie out of his trance. A pinch of salt. And that's what Aristide was to Haiti. We weren't told this till we were about to leave, that there was a riot going on in the prison. The head of the Tonton Macoutes was in prison, and he was rioting to come out and stage a coup. Labor unions were upset, and so we had this meeting with Aristide. So we go over there, and they say, oh, you got to wait. He's still talking to the labor unions. All of a sudden, that burst out, and they came running out, all these Haitians. And, I mean, so many of them come right up to our face and point, Aristide, and don't hurt him. But they were so elevated after he had talked to them.
Then, in full circle, Jack attended a fasting with Brian Wilson, the same type of fasting he was asked to first investigate when he was in the FBI.
I immediately went to D.C., and where Brian Wilson had started another fast for the Columbus Day. So that was a couple, September 1st, 1998, or 92, you know, 500 years from Columbus's discovery of the people here. And our theme was just pretty much 500 years, we're making reparation for the damage we've done, the white people from Europe have done to this continent. The people to the indigenous people, to the environment. But anyway, it was 42 days I fasted, and that was fascinating. And we were on the steps of the Capitol. Brian was there. Dave Dellinger was there. A lot of people joined us. Cesar Chavez for a while. Martin Sheen. Jim Wallace. There was a lot of people. Adolfo Perez Esquivel, former Nobel Prize winner from Argentina. He was with us for a while. Yeah, several days. Mm-hmm. And he was fascinating. He was there on the anniversary of getting fired. We had a little celebration, you know, a little seltzer water.
I asked Jack how he felt about the whole situation up until now.
Do you regret disobeying any orders which led to your being fired?
Did I regret? No, not at all. I've always felt good about what I did. It threw me in a whole new arena. Now I am a peace activist.
I also asked Jack his views on nonviolent direct action and getting active in politics out and inside one's community. What would you say to listeners who are listening right now about activism who may think it does nothing, doesn't solve the problems, is a waste of time?
look at everything going around. You have to overlook a lot of it, though. You know, you can't do it. I heard somebody say, no batter swings at every pitch. But on the other hand, no decent batter stands there and watches every pitch either. You got to do something. But, you know, look at everything, ignore most of it, but still do something and take some stand. And you don't know your effect, but at least you're affecting yourself by taking a stand on something. And you're not letting, you know, the problems change you. But I think everybody ought to be involved in something that's worthwhile and put some energy in it. And there's a dynamic that takes place when you are involved. You tend to get rub elbows with others that are involved, and you get energy from that. And you see, it's a dynamic. But, you know, and I call all the forms of activism, you know, other than just your job, but to really do something as a form of activity that you're actually doing. And that's a peace activist, is a person that's actually doing something about peace, against violence, and supporting nonviolence as a way. Nonviolence is a way of living. The whole area of nonviolence is something that's fascinated me, something I never understood. I certainly did not understand the notion of nonviolence, or it meant nothing, when I was a policeman or an FBI agent. Raising my own kids, because they used to fight a lot, and they seemed to, you know, it seemed to me that they hated each other, and it just bothered me so much. And I was raised very violently. You know, I think the Catholic Church is a very violent church. Christianity is a very violent religion, or it has been. And if you look at its roots, it's a nonviolent religion. It was Jesus trying to help people that were hurt, stop people from hurting others, and practicing nonviolence. And, you know, we think of violence as just hitting and slugging and stabbing. Racism is violence. Poverty is violence. Sexism is violence. Just my own kids, and trying to come to grips with why they seem to hate each other, bothered me, and I just, there had to be a better way, and we started trying to raise them nonviolently and take violence out as our way of disciplining. And that's the greatest start right there. When you hit a child, a little child, they catch on quick. You're telling them, you don't do that because I'm telling you not, and I'm bigger than you, and I can hurt you. And they catch that right away, and the way they get their way is they have to hurt somebody else. And they pick it up and take it through life. And we're taught that. And you can expand it to the military, that the military is how to handle problems by violence or threat of violence. And there's other ways, and our religion has really let us down, because it's kept that big secret, you know, that Christianity is a nonviolent religion. Judaism is a nonviolent religion. Islam is a nonviolent religion. But somehow violence is quicker, gets your point across right now. And but there's always a residual effect, always. I don't think any act of violence goes unanswered.
Jack Ryan did what most people would not do in his position, and that is disobey orders that are unjustified and immoral. It took him down another path in life that probably involved more struggles and hardships, but in return, he lived a fulfilling life that taught him more about humanity and peace. And Jack did it not because he had to, but because it was the right thing to do. There are many figures in our history, many of whom that were blacklisted, shunned, or murdered, who decided that there came a time when even intimidation to not step out of line and to follow orders that would lead to the abuse of power, and that it had to be stopped. These individuals have also taught us a great lesson in our history, and that is, in this broken system of ours, if you refuse to cooperate with your government, to inflict harm onto others, to embrace power and to betray those around you who need your help, you will be removed and exiled. But this is what we all must emulate. We must defy the power elite. We must sacrifice, as did Jack, our comfortable way of life so we can stop the assault that is meted out to others here in this country and in other countries around the world. To bring about justice and democracy, we must all face these problems together and take action, or we will fall deeper into passivity, because by then we will be unable to stop the degradation of this country and the destruction it causes around the world. Jack confronted this U.S. death machine, and we must do the same if we want a better life for others and for ourselves.
2, 3. This land was your land, but now it's my land. We'll drill their oil and invade their islands, cut down their forests, pollute their waters. This land was me conquering. You do it your way, and I'll do it my way. We'll kill the natives and build our highways, get starving for children. We'll kill Osama, then kill each other. This land was me conquering. This land was your land.
Well, that does it for our show today. Thanks for tuning in to the Solidarity Journal at WAZU 90.7 FM. Well, you'll hear more exposés about what's happening in your community and around the world. So check in every Tuesday at 6 a.m. and 2 p.m. for our weekly programming. Until then, keep up the resistance.